Hello, Illinois Radio Reader listeners. This is Elizabeth McMahon with the Pantograph for Friday, May 23rd, 2025. I'm going to start today on the front page and we have a lot of local news, and in the second half I will cover obituaries and some sports. But for the meantime, I'm going to start on the front page here. We have a Memorial Day photo, with the headline, Flags for Veterans. And we have a picture of a little girl here with an American flag in a cemetery. And the caption reads, Chloe Becker, age 5, places an American flag at the grave of a service member on Thursday, May 22nd at Park Hill Cemetery in Bloomington in preparation for Memorial Day. Becker joined her family and members of Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 454 in Bloomington to place the flags on veterans' graves. We also have a picture of Augie Schroeder, age 10, who's braving the cool, rainy weather to place flags. And just the top story here, running above the fold here, is a story focused on higher education with the headline, Foreign Student Reprieves Too Late. And this is an Associated Press story by Makira Seminara, Annie Ma, and Janie Haar. The shorter headline reads, The U.S. is reinstating records for international students. For some, it's too late. And I'll begin. After the government terminated his legal status in the U.S., one student abruptly lost his laboratory job in Houston, and fearing detention, he returned to his home country in South Asia on a one-way ticket. The Trump administration later reversed course in its expansive crackdown on international students, but there was a major obstacle. The student cannot return because his American visa was revoked. Without it, he's stranded, said the student, who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of retaliation. As the government begins reinstating students' records, many face a daunting and complicated path toward rebuilding their lives. For those who are left, there's no guarantee they can return. Others have faced challenges re-enrolling in school and returning to jobs. Mental anguish from their ordeals linger, as do feelings of vulnerability. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has expanded the grounds for terminating a student's legal status, leaving many to fear they could be targeted again. A total of more than 4,700 international students had their permission to study in the U.S. canceled this spring, with little notice or explanation. In court hearings, Department of Homeland Security officials said they ran the names of student visa holders through an FBI-run database that contains the names of suspects and people who have been arrested, even if they were never charged with a crime or had charges dropped. At a court hearing last week in Oakland, California, lawyers for international students sought a nationwide injunction they said would protect their clients and others across the country. But government attorneys said that wasn't necessary because ICE was mailing status reactivation letters to affected students. It likely will take 2 weeks for all students to receive their letter, which can then be shared with universities and employers, Assistant U.S. Attorney Elizabeth Curlan said. The plaintiff's lawyers said the letter is meaningless, arguing ICE's new policy suggests student records can be terminated on a whim. There's also no evidence ICE has asked the State Department to restore revoked visas, the plaintiff's attorneys said. The man in Houston left within about a week of learning his legal status had been terminated. Around that time, he also received an email that the visa he used to enter the U.S. had been revoked. He believes his termination stemmed from a 2021 fraud case that was dismissed. Over nearly a decade, he built his life in the U.S. where he was enrolled in optional practical training, which allows foreign students to stay and work for up to 3 years on their student visas. In his home country, he's now looking for work and living with his mother. The wait time for a U.S. visa interview is at least a year, he said. Even if he got another visa, returning would be complicated because of his financial situation. He had a car loan and credit cards in the U.S. that he can't afford to pay after losing his job, and his credit score has since dropped, he said. Revoking a visa or revoking SEVIS status does not just affect the educational side of things, it affects the whole life, said the student, who has struggled with feelings of loneliness and also grief over his father's recent death. SEVIS is the Student and Exchange Visitor Information Systems database that tracks international students' compliance with their visa status. Students who left the country may not have known their rights or had the resources to hire a lawyer, said Ben Loveman, an immigration attorney. They now will have a harder time being reinstated, he said. There were huge consequences, Loveman said. For a Nepali programmer in Texas who had his status terminated, the ordeal brought up a mistake he thought he had left in the past. The programmer, who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of retaliation, was arrested 4 years ago for drunken driving. He said he took responsibility for his actions, performing community service hours, serving probation, and paying fines. The judge told him the records could be sealed after 2 years, but the case appears to explain why he was targeted by immigration authorities. I followed everything, he said. If they're going to take it all, at least give me due process. His status has since been restored, and the programmer, who is on an OPT program, has gone back to his job, but the episode hasn't faded from his mind. If the right opportunity emerged in another country like New Zealand or Canada, he said he would take it and leave. A student at Iowa State University, who also requested anonymity out of concern about being targeted, said he is looking for options to leave the U.S. after what he describes as a dark period. The PhD student said his status termination pushed him to a mental breaking point. He had a plane ticket back home to Bangladesh reserved. He hardly left his apartment, and when he did, he felt he was being followed. He attributes his termination to pending charges against him for marijuana possession, but he said he hadn't been convicted. After his status reinstatement, he restarted a teaching assistant job he had lost. Then he had to catch up on grading almost 3 weeks of reassignments for dozens of students. While he's relieved to get back to school, he's confident about his decision to leave by the end of next year, either for home or Europe. The degree is not worth the risk of another status termination, he said. How much should I suffer to continue here, he said. Moving on the front page here, we have a column by D. Jack Alkire called The Cutting Board, and the headline reads, Chips May Be a Key to Kale. And I'll begin here. I've always wondered what it must feel like to wake up after hibernating a whole winter, unkempt, groggy, unsure what day it is or just how long you've been asleep. I'm sure the first few steps are wobbly. Anyway, let's see if we've still got it, because the cutting board is back. The downtown Bloomington Farmers Market returned earlier this month, but as any farmer will tell you, it takes some time into the season for the fruits of their labors to appear. However, there are some crops that are easier and more reliable to find at the market this time of year, like frilly kale, a leafy green in the brassica family related to cabbage and broccoli. Kyan Glenn knows kale throughout the summer at his farm, or grows kale, sorry, throughout the summer at his farm, the Table Farm and Workshop east of Bloomington. It's super healthy for you, he said. It's more like those superfoods because of all the vitamins and minerals that it contains. But from the farmer's perspective, it reliably produces even in the Illinois heat, so we bring a lot of it all summer long. Kale is a great source of vitamins C and K. According to data from the USDA, compared to percent daily values from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, one cup of kale has over 60% of the recommended daily intake of vitamin K and nearly 20% of vitamin C. Glenn likes to eat his raw kale in salads and as a leafy green alternative, he said, but many people like using his frilly kale to make kale chips, he noted. I have to be honest, I've done everything in my power, sought knowledge from the greatest of chefs and food sages and tried all manner of concoctions in my laboratory kitchen, and I have never found a way to cook kale that makes me say, I want some more. It's always one of those ingredients that I grit my teeth and fight through because I know it's good for me. Even when that kale craze hit over 10 years ago, I asked myself, what does everyone see in this bitter green? I've tried using it in salads, like a kale and strawberry salad with a sweet vinaigrette, or adding it to a bean stew, or cooking it down with some onions and garlic, but nothing has worked for me. Don't misunderstand me. I like greens. I made a whole pot of collards and turnip greens the other day. I recognize the importance of dark, leafy vegetables. Even last year, I tried making chard a couple different ways. But kale has remained elusive, almost menacing in its complexity. So let's give this kale chip thing a go. Maybe this will be the one thing that flips that switch and converts me, like Glenn, into a kale fanatic. Spoiler alert, not yet. A quick YouTube search found me a 90-second video from legendary French chef Jacques Pepin. In that video, he simply tosses his chopped kale with some oil and salts in it. In the video, he spreads the kale out on a cooking sheet with a wire rack and roasts it at 250 degrees Fahrenheit for 30 to 35 minutes. Simple enough, right? Kind of. Pepin's kale came out crispy and maintained its color. Most of mine did, but there were a few issues that I would change and suggest for anyone trying this at home. Just know that your kitchen will smell unique afterward. First, remove the stems. Being thicker than the leaves, they're going to cook at a different rate than the broader leaves. If you leave them in, you wind up with a crunchy leaf and a chewy, fibrous stem that just feels warmed up instead of cooked. Second, spread the kale out as evenly as possible. Any portions that are clumped up will result in crispy outer parts with soggy, undone chips within. Third, go easy on the salt. I use one bunch of kale and a teaspoon of kosher salt. For something like this, that was too much salt. In fact, if I were to make this again, I'd probably wait until after cooking to lightly sprinkle with salt and any other seasonings like garlic powder or black pepper. Was this a success? I'd say yes, in the simple fact that I will be trying this again. Am I a bona fide kale lover? Sorry, no. The search continues. I'm going to move on to page A2 of the pantograph, and we have several local stories here. And I'll start at the top with an education-focused story with the headline, District 87 Students' Test Scores Improve. Budget adds money for projects, and this is by D. Jack Alkire. Elementary students across Bloomington District 87 showed greater than average academic growth across the board, something especially exciting for Sheridan Elementary, as last year it was considered at risk. In addition to hearing about student progress, the school board, which met Wednesday at Bloomington High School, also heard about budget amendments to cover added expenses for BHS and the Bloomington Career Academy. When a school's student scores, are not meeting a certain threshold, such as a large percentage of students scoring below the 20th percentile in reading, literacy, and math, that school is obligated to involve the American Institute of Research in order to develop an improvement plan, said the district's Assistant Superintendent of Teaching and Learning, Nicole Rummel. The areas of improvement suggested by the AIR for Sheridan mirrored Principal Danelle Barron-Haar's list perfectly, Rummel said. Clearly, they have a lot of faith in the direction that the district's going and the things that are happening in the school, she said. The district's elementary schools are also tracking students' progress with reading, early literacy, and math using STAR assessments, a standardized test for students taken during the fall and spring semesters that measures how many students test above the 20th percentile of learners at their age level. In general, every school showed improved scores from fall 2024 to spring 2025, with the largest increase in Irving Elementary by 28% above the 20th percentile in early literacy. Our teachers have had a lot of training and support. It's really paying off, and our students are just doing really well, Rummel said. The board also heard about amended budgets from both the district as a whole and the Bloomington Career Academy, formerly the Bloomington Area Career Center. We have a current fund balance of about $1.2 million, said Bryce Hansen, director of the BCA. We need to expend out of that a couple of things that were not anticipated when we made our budget about a year ago. The larger of the two expenses was a $437,000 purchase of welding equipment for the new Willie G. and Gloria Brown Education Center, formerly known as the Oakland Avenue Building, he said. That's welders, hoods, fume extraction booths, all sorts of other expensive equipment. This is a very substantial amount of money. However, it can be reimbursed by a DCEO grant, Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, in partnership with Heartland Community College, Hansen said. While the reimbursement may take some time, Hansen said he's confident the BCA is fiscally well-positioned for any future expenses. Michael Cornale, Chief Facilities and Financial Officer for the district, presented an amended budget that included an increased expense in professional services such as design and engineering work at the Brown Education Center. Originally slated at $600,000, it had grown to $1.2 million. In order to offset that increase, the district must move money from the working cash fund to the capital projects fund, he said, something that requires a board vote. However, because there is also ongoing work to repair the district's tennis courts at the corner of East Locust Street and South Towanda Avenue, the district needs an additional $500,000 to cover those professional services, Cornale said. My initial ask was $1.2 million from working cash to capital projects. When I came back to the final iteration at June's meeting, I for sure will need $1.7 million. That reflects the tennis court project in progress because the city and the $500,000 that they're willing to invest hasn't come in yet, Cornale said. The board is expected to vote on the amended budget during its next meeting on June 18th. And next we have another budget-focused story with the headline, Unit 5 Amended Budget Shows Tax Revenue Cost Increases. And this is by Drew Zimmerman. Additional property tax revenue, increased bus service costs, and prorated state funding were some of the changes to McLean County Unit 5's amended fiscal 2025 budget. The budget passed in September was originally a $222 million spending plan. The adjusted budget presented during Wednesday's board meeting was a $239 million spending plan, but is still projected to be balanced, district officials said. Marty Hickman, Chief Financial Officer for the district, said the Education Fund, which is the district's primary operating fund, is projected to receive another $2.2 million in property tax revenue, federal revenue, and interest. However, salaries and benefits for additional hires have caused a $4 million projected increase in expenditures. In total, Education Fund revenues increased from about $147.3 million to about $156.9 million, while expenditures increased from about $140.6 million to $151.8 million. This assumes that all expenditure values are used, and traditionally that doesn't happen, Hickman said. Revenues for the district's Transportation Fund are down $489,000 due to ongoing issues with the state not full funding school districts at their foundation level. Unit 5's Transportation Fund only received about 79% of its full amount this year, Hickman said. The fund also saw a $1.46 million increase to its bus services through First Student because of additional routes. To cover those deficits, a $1.5 million working cash transfer is being used to boost the fund. Total revenues increased from $14.5 million to $15.7 million, but expenditures jumped from $16.4 million to $1.78 million. Should the district fail to receive the last of four state payments to its transportation fund by the end of the fiscal year, Hickman said this deficit could be greater. Operations and Maintenance Fund revenues increased from $15.2 million to $17.3 million. This allowed the district to cover $900,000 in additional building repairs and overdue equipment purchases and keep the fund balanced this fiscal year. The district's Tort Fund stayed relatively the same. The Fire Prevention and Safety Fund saw a roughly $10 million increase, which was caused by the issuance of a roughly $10 million health life safety bond authorized by the school board last month. The money is meant to cover immediate capital projects needed for school facilities until revenue from the county's 1% sales tax starts to come in. Bond payments would be covered by the sales tax revenue, which is anticipated to lower the property tax burden on district residents. The board is expected to vote on the amended budget during its next meeting on June 18th. Moving on to more crime-focused stories here, we have a story by Caitlin Klepek with the headline, Peoria Man Sentenced to 7 Years on Gun Charge in McLean County. A Peoria man has been sentenced to 7 years in prison after pleading guilty to a felony gun charge in McLean County. Lonnie L. Kimbrough, 29, had been scheduled for a jury trial on Monday, with Judge William Yoder presiding and Kimbrough representing himself. Kimbrough instead submitted a guilty plea on Monday afternoon. He'd initially been charged with 2 counts of unlawful use of a weapon by a felon, Class 2 felonies, and 1 count of armed habitual criminal, a Class X felony. As part of the agreement, the prosecution, represented by Assistant State's Attorney Aaron Frederick, dismissed one of the unlawful use charges and the Class X charge, and Kimbrough pleaded guilty to 1 count of, that would be Class 5 charge, I think. Kimbrough pleaded guilty to 1 count of unlawful use of a weapon by a felon. Kimbrough's 7-year sentence is to be completed at 50%, and he earned 191 days credit for time already spent in jail. Yoder also ordered him to complete 1 year of mandatory supervised release following his prison term. Kimbrough's co-defendant, James P. LaShore, 44, of Bloomington, had been charged with the same 3 offenses. In January, LaShore pleaded guilty to the armed habitual criminal charge and was sentenced to 10 years in prison with credit for 239 days already served, to be followed by 3 years of mandatory supervised release. The charges stem from June 2, 2024, when the men were pulled over for speeding on East Market Street in Bloomington, according to a probable cause statement read in court later that week. Kimbrough was the driver and LaShore was the front seat passenger. LaShore ran from police, but Kimbrough cooperated, the statement said. Officers searched the vehicle and found a loaded .38 caliber pistol, an open bottle of alcohol, and 3 grams of cannabis. At that time, Kimbrough was released and LaShore was caught and detained, but Kimbrough's release was later revoked. And in other crime news here, we have another story by Caitlin Klepek. Cook County man acquitted on McLean County firearm charges. A Cook County man has been acquitted of 2 felony firearm charges following a McLean County jury trial. Jerome Camphor, 53, of Hazel Crest, and co-defendant Marjo S. Smith, 52, of Bloomington, had each been facing 3 charges. Prosecutors said Camphor was found in possession of a firearm, having been convicted of a felony in 2005 and 2010, and Smith had a firearm after being convicted of a felony in 1994 and 2009, according to court documents. In November 2023, Smith pleaded guilty to 1 count of violating the FOID Act, and his remaining charges were dismissed. He was sentenced to 2 years and 5 months in prison, with credit for 441 days already served, to be followed by 6 months of mandatory supervised release. A 12-person jury was sworn in Monday for Camphor's trial. After about a day of evidence and arguments, the jury returned not guilty verdicts late Tuesday afternoon, after about 2 hours of deliberations. The jury acquitted Camphor of the armed habitual criminal and unlawful use of a weapon charges. The Class 3 felony count was dismissed. And in other news, moving on page A4 of the Pantograph, we have a story by Drew Zimmerman with the headline, Downtown Bloomington Receives Cultural District Status, Eligible for $3 million in Grants. The City of Bloomington was one of 5 entities recognized as state-designated cultural districts, according to a news release from the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity. This special status is awarded to communities, towns, or specific geographic areas in Illinois for the purpose of encouraging economic development, supporting the preservation of historically or culturally significant structures, fostering local cultural development, and celebrating communities' unique cultural identities, the news release said. Illinois is committed to preserving our vibrant histories and cultures, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton stated in the release. These new cultural district designations will showcase and celebrate their diversity while driving the local economy forward. Designees will have the opportunity to apply for $3 million in funding that is meant to support these goals. This grant funding will not only expand economic development opportunities, but it will do so while preserving the historical and cultural significance of these communities, DCEO Director Kristen Richards stated. Cordero Patrick, Bloomington's Director of Community Impact and Enhancement, said the city's streetscape plan will create new opportunities to expand public art in downtown Bloomington and could be funded with this money. As part of the streetscape plan, there are cultural art projects worked into that we're expected to do in the first phase, Patrick said. This just allows us to have access to more funds. The other four state-designated cultural districts are in the Austin African American Business Networking Association in Chicago, the City of Rockford, Self-Reliance Association in Chicago, and Vienna High School. And in related news here, we have a story by Drew Zimmerman with the headline, Bloomington, Farmer City, Receive State Funding for Mobility Projects. The cities of Bloomington and Farmer City are among the recipients of the $139.2 million awarded this week through the Illinois Transportation Enhancement Program. The goal of this program is to expand local travel options and enhance the quality of life for communities statewide, according to the governor's office. Today, I'm proud to announce the largest investment in the program's history, with more than $139 million going toward bike lanes, sidewalks, trails, and other local improvements, Governor J.B. Pritzker said in a news release issued Wednesday. This is just one of the state's larger efforts to reverse decades of disinvestment and create more connected communities. According to a news release from the Illinois Department of Transportation, projects were awarded based on their readiness, connection to transportation networks, and other economic drivers, as well as their ability to secure public support and provide public benefits. Bloomington received close to $800,000 to extend Constitution Trail from Lafayette Street to Hamilton Road. The 10-foot-wide multi-use asphalt path will run parallel to Bunn Street before diverging northwest to cross underneath Interstate 55 by way of an existing underpass. Farmer City received $488,700 to construct a half-mile-long sidewalk on Clinton Avenue from Main to Summer Streets. And to wrap up this half, I'm going to do two little news briefs here. One is by Olivia Jacobs with the headline, Books to Benefit Sale, June 12th through 14th. Books to Benefit will host its semi-annual book sale from June 12th to 14th at 360 Wiley Drive, Suite 700 in Normal. The sale will be open 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, June 12th, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Friday, June 13th, and 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday, June 14th. A $10 admission is required on Thursday. Over 25,000 donated books will be available for sale. Hardbacks are $2 or $1 for children's, and all paperbacks are 50 cents. Specially bound classic works and contemporary novels published within the last calendar year will be $5. Books to Benefit will stop taking in-person donations for the sale on May 28th and will resume on July 2nd. Funds from the sale support the STAR Adult Literacy Program, Heartland Community College Scholarships, Youth Build of McLean County, and Books for Bloomington Normal Kids. Visit bookstobenefit.com for more information. And finally, we have a brief with the headline, Lawmaker Starts Reading Program by D. Jack Alkire. State Representative Reagan Deering, a Republican from Decatur, has launched a summer reading program called Reading is Sweet to encourage students in kindergarten through fifth grade to hit the books this summer. The program is open to students who live in or attend school in the 88th House District, which includes all or portions of DeWitt, Livingston, Macon, McLean, and Piatt counties, including the outskirts of Bloomington and Decatur. To join, students must read 8 books over the break and have their parent or guardian certify that the book was finished, a news release explained. Books over 150 pages in length can count as 2 books, and books read for other reading programs count as well. Those who complete the program will be invited to an ice cream party with Deering later this summer and will receive an official House of Representatives certificate showing their achievement. I'm going to take a short break and return with the second half hour of the Pantograph for Friday, May 23rd. Please stay tuned.